And we return as today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman on this Thursday afternoon. Well, today we begin with an update on the state of the ports of Miami-Dade. Of course, the prime county entry points for travelers and cargo are the Port of Miami and Miami International Airport. Joining us now is Miguel Southwell, the Deputy Director of Miami-Dade Aviation Department. Welcome to you, Miguel Southwell.
Good to be here, Joe.
Also with us is Manny Mencia. He's World Trade Center Miami Board Member and Senior Vice President of International Trade and Business Development Unit of Enterprise Florida. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
And we'll learn more about those entities.
Yes, we will.
And joining us by phone is the director of the Port of Miami, Bill Johnson. Thanks for joining in, Bill. Good to have you with us.
Certainly. Thank you.
So let's begin with you, Mr. Southwell. Tell us the latest from Miami International Airport, including the sequester effect.
And customs.
And customs. Thank you. Let me give you the good news first.
Okay.
And the good news is that over the last 2-3 years, we have had record-breaking traffic in both passengers and cargo. We're actually the fastest growing airport from a passenger point of view and freight point of view. We have now surpassed JFK as having the most international flights of any U.S. airport. And the other side of the coin is that that brings some challenges for us. With such rapid growth, of course, because we have so much of our traffic is international, of course, we have to deal with the customs and immigration issues. The sequestration program has affected disproportionately Miami International Airport because of our large size of both international passengers and cargo. And so as Joe was just stating, because the overtime budget has been cut in that program, we're having challenges in terms of getting passengers through customs on a reasonable period of time, and also the examination of freight in a reasonable period of time. This is of a special concern of ours because half of our passengers are simply connecting, and therefore if they have a difficult time getting through customs and immigration, then they'll choose other gateways. And as for the freight side of our house, a significant portion of our freight are perishable goods that, as they land at Miami International Airport, have to be distributed very quickly across the rest of the country in refrigerated trucks. And so we can't afford to have those perishable goods, cut flowers, fruits and vegetables, sitting on the ground.
So what are you doing to address those issues?
It's a huge community effort. Both all of our legislators are working feverishly to be able to get additional customs officers. The existing customs, and I have to give credit to the existing staffing and workforce for customs and immigration. They're doing all they can with what they have to work. And so it's a legislative effort, and everyone from the governor's office to our representatives in Congress are all working very hard to give us additional funding and additional officers.
Miguel Southwell, Deputy Director of Miami-Dade Aviation Department. Tell me, Bill Johnson joining us by telephone. He's the director of the Port of Miami. Tell us about the issues you're facing. And, of course, there's two big projects with the port, the tunnel and, of course, the dredging. Give us an update.
Yep. Sure. I'm actually calling you from Washington. Been up on Capitol Hill yesterday and this morning. Working specifically up here on our dredge, deepening of our container harbor to the 52 foot, which will be in sync with the opening of the Panama Canal. So literally just about 2 years from now, Miami will emerge as the only container port south of Virginia on the east coast of the United States at the same depth as Panama. So we're in sync. We're very fortunate as a community and certainly at Port Miami to be in the position to be able to deepen the harbor to, again, the same water depth on the same schedule as Panama. So I'm up here headed back later today from Washington working that issue. We expect that the Army Corps of Engineers, who will do the work, do the oversight of the dredge project, we're expecting them to actually award the contract within the next 2 weeks, and the actual project will commence, physical work will commence in early June, opening in 2 years from now in May of 2015. So we're excited.
Bill Johnson, what are some of the chief problems facing the cruise industry? We've had a lot of recent mishaps and infection outbreaks.
Sure.
Has it affected business at the port?
Absolutely not. First of all, cruise industry is robust. It's healthy. The cruise industry is one of the safest modes of transportation anywhere in the world. So when you look at the number of incidents, they're relatively very small in number in comparison, if you will, to the volume of people. Over the last several years, there have been over 100 million people having taken a cruise. So it's the numbers are very, very small, and the industry is very focused, both at the cruise line level as well as their CLIA and their national international associations, very focused on both environmental issues, safety of the crew and the passengers. So that's obviously in Florida last year. The three key ports and cruise ports in Florida, which are of course Port Miami, the busiest cruise port in the world, second Canaveral, and then Port Everglades. Between the three ports, 60% of all cruise activity in America, United States, last year occurred through a Florida port. Miami, we're the only port.
But some of my friends are still a little shaky about going on a cruise these days. Is that needless?
Mode of transportation. I mean, seriously, when you look at modes of movement and transportation, the cruise industry is by far the safest industry out there. So, and again, these incidents, they're unfortunate. With the exception of last year, the Concordia, again, which was a tragedy, it was an accident. But when you look at the cruise industry and the incidents we've had over the last number of months, there's no injury there. There's no crew or passenger that's injured. Now, maybe they're inconvenienced. And again, in this particular case, Carnival Corp has stepped up and is investing hundreds of millions of dollars to put redundancy systems in place, et cetera, et cetera. So for anyone to suggest that the cruise industry isn't sensitive and concerned about the welfare, the safety of the passenger and the crew, it's just that's totally an outrageous kind of a comment. And some people have made those comments. But we get to this point. We're the only port in the world in Miami that's hit the 4 million mark. We did four successive years at 4 million plus. This season, starting in October, Port Miami will hit the 5 million mark. We're moving up to 4.95 million. Those are 2020 numbers. We're hitting those numbers starting in the fall of 13 coming up. So clearly excited. We have three brand new cruise companies, new cruise lines. Starting this fall, MSC, the fourth largest cruise line in the world, will sail year-round with one of their newest and largest ships, the Divina. This past fall, we had joined our fleet. Regent Seven Seas, the luxury brand, joined our fleet, as did Disney. So we're very excited. We've grown the number of brands. We literally have brought in a number of major new cruise ships. Four new cruise ships actually came to America this past year. Three of those ships have home ported with us, and that, of course, includes Carnival's newest and largest, the Breeze, which sails year-round out of Miami. So we're excited to work with all of our partners at Royal Caribbean, Norwegian Cruise Line. Starting February, less than a year from now, we will actually be, if you will, fortunate to have year-round service from Norwegian Cruise Line's newest, The Getaway.
Okay, Bill, we have a lot of ground to cover. Bonnie?
Yeah, sure. Mr. Johnson, I just want to ask you, because when this program was posted that it was going to be on today, Blanca wrote on Facebook, what will be, getting back to the Deep Dredge project, what will be the environmental impact of the Deep Dredge on Biscayne Bay and offshore coral reefs?
It's actually positive. This is the highest standard in American history for a dredge. We're investing upwards of $20 million. The project is round numbers $200 million. We have $20 million for safeguards and for environmental remediation. There's not a project in the United States of America in terms of a dredge project that has met or exceeds this standard. So we're very sensitive. Ours is a green port, and we're very proud of the fact that Port Miami is, in fact, a leading port in America in terms of sustainability and the whole green movement. So we're very, very total safeguards in place. The community does not need to be concerned. This is a very clean project. This is an extremely environmentally sensitive project.
Let's move to Manny Mencia of the World Trade Center Miami. He's a board member there and also with Enterprise Florida. What do you have to tell us, Manny?
Well, I think the exciting thing is that yesterday we kicked off World Trade Month. It's a month-long celebration of international business and its impact in Miami and in the state of Florida. It's going to include a whole variety of activities here in Miami. Miami, of course, being the most international, location.
What does it mean to the average bloke living in Miami-Dade County? Or
well, it's
this month celebration business.
The celebration is an opportunity to be educated on the opportunities in international business, to tour the port and airport. But the main issue is to highlight the importance of international business to this community.
Do I really want to tour the airport? I just want to get out of there.
You may enjoy seeing some of the...
I know there's some art exhibits and things like that. But
if what you do want to do is learn about the impact of international business in your everyday life, over 1 million jobs in the state of Florida, that's 1 out of every 7 in the state, depends on international business. And the most interesting thing is it's an industry that pays much higher than average wages. For example, logistics and trade jobs, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, pay 30% higher than average wages in the state of Florida. So it's not only a sector that creates jobs, but a sector that also pays the type of wages that we want our kids to be earning. And this is an opportunity to kick the tires, learn about international business, take a seminar, for example, on best practices for importing, exporting, or doing business in Africa, or basic export, or exporting to China. So if you're a company or even an individual and you want to get into international business, this month of activities is going to provide a lot of activities for you to become active and to become proficient.
That's Manny Mencia from the World Trade Center and Enterprise Florida. We also have Miguel Southwell, Deputy Director of Miami-Dade Aviation Department, and Bill Johnson, Director of the Port of Miami. On today's Topical Currents, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back and take some calls.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Miguel Southwell, Manny Mencia, and Director of the Port of Miami, Bill Johnson. If you'd like to join in, we have some lines open, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Also, if you're a little shy, email radio@WLRN.org, radio@WLRN.org. Miguel Southwell, so many people just really hate to travel by air today because of security measures and overcrowded flights. Is this considered by airline leaders and regulators?
Well, of course. I mean, air travel is inherently an anxious type of activity.
It used to be such a pleasure.
Well, and some people still do consider it to be. But more than anything else, the benefit that air travel brings is, in terms of Miami International Airport, is that it really is the chief economic development tool for this community, and any airport in any community is. And we, for us, we see some major opportunities before us. The BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, represent significant growth in economic development. And if, as I said, you view the airport as this economic tool, and we're not doing all we can to build additional service to these economies, in Asia, for example, over the next 20 years between 2010 and 2030, in those 20 years, the Asian middle class is going to grow from 500 million to 3.2 billion middle-class individuals.
And these, well, can we go back to local? What's the status of the MIA transportation hub system?
Again, it's alive and well. In the next 18 months, we will have a fully integrated system where one can take the train from just about anywhere in South Florida and get to the airport and transfer to an aircraft. All those things, again, preparing for what we believe will be a major
including growth. Miami Beach?
Including Miami Beach. Uh-huh. Including Miami Beach. I mean, there will be some, as far as Miami Beach, you'll have to, of course, first take the bus to the train system. Today we have, if you know anyone in Miami Beach who's used this service, we already have a bus service that's an express service from the beach to the airport, and it's very popular with Miami Beach residents.
I was thinking on another subject with June 1st around the corner, how prepared we are both at the port and at the airport for a hurricane and what measures have been taken to provide for that.
Maybe we should start with the port.
We'll start with, okay, Mr. Johnson, we'll start with you.
Well, good question. Security, safety, security, the highest priority for any port, including ours here in Miami. We have a team of professionals that, in what you call layered security, that work in safety and security, involving our federal partners. In this case, it would be the U.S. Coast Guard, plays a direct role in any event, especially in a tropical storm or a hurricane. But you also have involvement of all of our crews and our container partners, our crews and shipping lines. So it's an integrated plan. It's a plan which doesn't just sit on a shelf. We do a lot of interaction. In fact, there's been communication this week between various entities. So we have, we have our necessary plans. They're very detailed. They're very specific. And we do trial runs, dry run through. We do tabletop exercises after every event. We have a post review by everybody. So it's an integrated approach, and it's a very comprehensive approach, and the objective is to again keep the port open, working up until the very last minute, and then to be able to reopen as soon as humanly possible, because again, just like the airport, but you've got literally every hour you're delayed, you're talking hundreds of thousands and into the millions of dollars a day of business,
right?
So you got to be safe, secure, but you got to also be able to function and operate.
Mr. Southwell, concerning Miami International Airport and perhaps Opa-locka, also part of the county system, if we're really hit with the big one, it's going to be so important to be able to get supplies in. How well prepared, how far are you looking ahead?
Well, for the most part, as it relates to air service, what you tend to have are delays. This time of year, of course, we go through all the exercises, as you might expect. But for the most part, all we're facing is the challenge of once you have the storm, even if it's not a hurricane, airline employees are not allowed to work on the ramp once you start having the lightning and so forth, which we'll have during...
We know all about that.
Exactly. Right. So for the most part, the major impact is really just trying to clear the backlog of delayed passengers.
Let's take a telephone call or two. We've got Diane. She's in Miami Beach. Hi.
Hi, this is directed to Mr. Johnson. Some years ago, the port did some dredging and dynamiting, and I live on Dalito Island, and I felt the vibration, and it caused a lot of cracks in my house. Was that what you intend to do now?
There's minimal blasting.
I could feel the vibration. I was amazed, since I'm not right, on the MacArthur Causeway, but yet I could...
Sure, the last dredge, which was completed in 2005, the work was undertaken in 04, 05. Mm-hmm. I think there were a total of 30 blasts on that one, if I have the information correct.
Yeah, I don't
and
know, in my house
blasts
over 40
are controlled.
Years, so I don't
it's about 90% less impact. So you're talking of a normal dynamite blast. It's about a 10% impact of what would be a normal blast. It's controlled, which means that from both air, there's a helicopter overhead, and there's 5 boats surrounding it to monitor for the protection of the sea life in terms of vibrations. Everything is recorded, so it's very precise.
And we'll move along to Marty. He's in Coconut Creek. Hi.
Hi. I was just wondering, when I heard about expanding the port, to me, it doesn't make logistically or economic sense. Be expanding a port at the end of a 500-mile sandbar to take in products from the most efficient method of transportation, which is these large tankers and put them on trucks and move to the rest of the country. Why aren't the ships going up to either Jacksonville or ports in the Carolinas, which are much more logistically appropriate?
Okay, we're short on time. Let Mr. Johnson address that.
Real simple answer to that. Miami is in the center of the hemisphere. We're the first inbound port. We're the last export port. Deep dredge allows us to bring in container ships carrying triple the amount of containers, not 4,000, but up to 12,000, 13,000. It represents 10 to 12 billion additional dollars of value by being at 50 feet. We win by rail. From Miami by rail, okay, one of the largest grants in American history to a port came to us from Washington a couple of years ago. This fall, we start on dock, on port rail. We hit over 70% of the entire U.S. population by rail in 4 days or less. We get you to Cleveland, Chicago, to Memphis, to Charlotte, North Carolina, in less time and less cost. First inbound, last outbound, we did nearly $28 billion of economic value through your port last year. We did 207,000 jobs through your port last year. We're the highest-paying industry segment in town. With a high school diploma, the average job through your port is $56,000 a year. By deepening to 50 feet, you're going to create at least an additional $10 to $12 billion of economic value. You will create 33,000 new additional high-paying jobs over the next balance of this decade. It makes absolutely the most economic sense. Miami emerges in less than 2 years as the most efficient port on the East Coast of America. I wish Savannah well. I wish Norfolk, Virginia well. I'm in the business of growing Florida's business, specifically Miami's business, and along the way creating tens and tens of thousands of new high-paying jobs.
We understand that, Mr. Johnson. We're a little short on time. We need to cover something else.
Yeah, Mr. Mencia, tell us more about Enterprise Florida.
And how about contact information for people who want to learn more about the World Trade Center Miami?
Absolutely.
Quickly.
Enterprise Florida is the official economic development organization of the state of Florida. We are, a private not-for-profit corporation, but chaired by the governor and responsible to our legislature, whose mission is to grow the economy of the state of Florida and create employment opportunities for our companies. We can be found on the web or www.florida.com. World Trade Center, www.worldtradecenter.org, the same thing. World Trade Center is Miami-based. It's an organization that's provided tremendous benefit to the state of Florida and available for any company that wants to expand in Florida.
Well, we certainly want to thank all three of our gentlemen guests. I think we'll plan another program where we have more time to delve into some of these issues. I know we had a lot of callers that we couldn't get on the air. I want to thank Miguel Southwell, Deputy Director of the Miami-Dade Aviation Department. Also thanks to Manny Mencia. He's also affiliated with the Enterprise Florida and is with the World Trade Center. He's a board member there. And the Director of the Port of Miami, Bill Johnson. Thank all of you gentlemen very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Food and Dining, up next. And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, our Thursday edition this afternoon. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Well, Bonnie, the popular Cinco de Mayo Mexican celebration dates back to 1862.
Oh, so I didn't know that.
151 years later, it's still a worldwide vibrant part of the culture. And joining us now is chef, author, and syndicated columnist, my longtime friend, Linda Gassenheimer. Linda, we have a special guest to talk about the delights of true Mexican cuisine. So what's on the menu?
What's on the menu? Well, first
not
of all,
not just tacos and nachos.
Cinco de Mayo, some people may not know, is May 5th, coming up this weekend.
And commemorates a battle.
It
It's not Independence Day.
It's a day for it's a day for mariachi music and margaritas and salsas and lots of fun. And in fact, you know what? It's such a popular. We love a party here in Miami anyway. It's so popular.
There's some good spots in Miami for Cinco de Mayo.
Right. And some restaurants have not just Sunday. It's the whole weekend. It's going to be a party weekend here. And as you mentioned, there's more to Mexican food than just Tex-Mex. And here to help us is television host Patty Hinich. And her book is called, and also her PBS series is called.
And we've been carrying that on WLRN-TV.
Here. Exactly, Patty's Mexican Table.
Mm-hmm.
So she's going to help us plan our own festivities. Let's welcome her. Patty Hinich, welcome.
Hi, Linda. Hi, thank you for having me on.
No, our pleasure. Our pleasure for sure. So if you couldn't guess, our topic today is Mexican foods. Call us with your questions. Maybe you have an ingredient you're looking for. Or do you have a special Mexican recipe you'd like to share with us? Our expert will have your answers. Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576. And do we have email, Bonnie?
We do. It's radio@WLRN.org. radio@WLRN.org.
And with us, our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype, and he writes the wine suggestions for my Dinner Minutes columns. And also, you can read his column in today's Miami Herald. Fred, are we drinking today?
Absolutely. You talk about Mexican wine or food, and I'll talk about Mexican wine. How's that?
Mm. Sounds good to me. Are you going to leave out the beer?
Yes, actually, I am.
Uh-oh. All right. Well, let's hear about that.
No Dos Equis?
No.
Who knows? Patty Hinich, congratulations on Patty's Mexican Table. It's really a beautiful book. I've got it here in front of me. It's got magnificent pictures in it. And Joe alluded to the date of the holiday, but tell us, what does it commemorate? It's not really Independence Day, is it?
It's not. And, you know, whenever I see my Mexican friends here in the U.S., we always look at each other baffled at how this Cinco de Mayo thing has exploded in the United States. Because in Mexico, Cinco de Mayo is a very local celebration and not this festive. It's quite somber, and it only happens, or mostly happens, in the state of Puebla, because we commemorate a battle that was won by the people from Puebla against the French in the 1860s. It was a short-lived triumph, only a couple of days, and the French won right back. But this battle has been an excuse.
Oh, I didn't know that. The French won back
shortly
after that?
Yes, they did.
Okay.
So it was, it's very funny, Linda. It was a very small Mexican militia won against this huge French battalion, but they only won for a couple of days. Then the French won right back, and after a couple of years, the emperor was executed, and then Mexico became an independent nation again. But, however, fast forward to today, Cinco de Mayo has become so huge in the United States that many people think it's our 4th of July.
Right, right.
You know, well, I always thought it was the anniversary of the invention of the margarita. Shows on the
that is so funny, because that's what it seems to be. I mean, we all, Mexicans love these. We, you know, like you in Miami, Mexicans love a party, and we love any excuse to celebrate and eat Mexican food and listen and dance to Mexican music. But we're all thinking, what is going on, you know? It's very funny. It's just an excuse to celebrate Mexicanness, anything Mexican. So, of course, we all Mexicans love it. But when you go back to Mexico, if you go and visit on a Cinco de Mayo, the kids are going to school. It's not a national holiday, not a festive day. Things are just going on.
Well, okay, so Mexican food, we usually think of it as Tex-Mex, like nachos and fajitas and that kind of thing. But as you mentioned in your book and on your program, it's much more than that. So tell us a little bit about the real Mexican food. What are some of your favorite dishes?
It is so much more than that, Linda. And that's why I focus in my cookbook on home-style Mexican cooking, because I think there have been like two or three Mexican staples that have become sort of very famous in the U.S. and have transformed themselves. If you go to Mexico, you won't see a burrito in the style that you find it here, where there's anything and everything except the sink inside of a tortilla.
And, no McDonald's breakfast burritos?
No McDonald's breakfast burritos. In fact, in Mexico, burritos or burritas, because we call them by the feminine, they only have one filling. And as I have in the cookbook, and this is one of my favorite foods, you have the chilorio, which is, this is one of my favorites. It's meat, usually pork or chicken, that is first cooked, covered with fresh squeezed orange juice and a little bit of salt until the meat renders off all of the fat and it becomes so soft, it's like coming off of itself. And then you finish it off with an ancho chili sauce that's not spicy, but it's nice and complexly layered, and it becomes sort of a like a sloppy joe filling with Mexican flavors, a little bit moist, and that's what usually goes inside of a burrito. Just simple.
Your description is making us all very, very drunk.
Now the fifth is Sunday. Could you come and cook some of this for us?
Right.
But let me tell you.
And we'll show you Miami.
Oh, listen, I love Miami. I was telling Linda that I have a sister who's actually a pastry chef and lives in Miami. She's there with you, and she's a much better cook than I am.
She has a bistro.
Okay, well, leave us her number off the air.
She can invite us there, okay.
Absolutely. She's she's based in Aventura, and she also started with a food truck. She's a pastry chef. She specializes in Latin style or Mexican style, like cupcakes and cookies. It's Alisa's Painted Bistro.
Alisa's Painted Bistro. But let's go on to, I'm intrigued by your chicken a la trash. In the book. Tell us about chicken a la trash.
I love you noticed. And this was a discussion that I had with my editor. She's like, Patty, do you really want to call it that? And I was like, well, that's its name. And it makes sense. It makes sense because you're throwing together so many ingredients that rationally wouldn't make sense together. For example, you have potatoes and poblano peppers and prunes.
Is that a Mexican thing?
We eat a lot of prunes and raisins and cranberries and dried fruits. That's a big thing in Mexico. And then that dish is finished off with sunflower seeds and pumpkin seeds. And it's just a delightful combination. You don't need to eat anything else because you have the chicken and the potatoes and the vegetables. And I told my editor, you know, I think that once people get over the shock, if they try the recipe, they're just going to crack up with a name.
Right. Okay, so let's say we want to have a Mexican fiesta party this weekend at home. Give us some ideas. What are some simple dishes we can make?
Of course. First of all, you can make gorgeous Mexican salads that are, you know, much better, exotic and interesting, much more than the usual potluck salads you will find. That parties, I think people usually don't know what to do with a salad. And it doesn't have to be a boring thing. It can be an exciting thing. I have a recipe in the cookbook for a hot palm and avocado and grape tomato salad.
For what was the first ingredient?
It's hearts of palm.
Oh, hearts of palm. Okay, you cracked. The phone connection was a little difficult.
Yeah, and my accent doesn't help either, I guess.
Well, that's all right. We're
it's charming.
Yes, it's adorable.
So it's very easy to make. It's hearts of palm, corn. We're getting into the season. Tomatoes, and you can choose all different flavors of grape or baby tomatoes, avocado, ripe avocado, and then it has a light dressing, a very simple dressing, and it's a salad that's easy to make, it's refreshing, it's interesting. So I would start with a couple of salads. I have another one that's also delicious in the cookbook, that's made with jicama. Have you guys tried jicama?
Yes, I happen to love jicama. And, you know, when I was in Mexico City one time, I was at a street market, and they as a snack, I was just amazed. They cut the jicama fresh right there, and they put a little bit of lemon juice on it, and you just eat it as a snack. And it's just wonderful, raw jicama. And that's J-I-C-A-M-A. I think I spelled it right.
You and, did.
And it's in the markets here. It's a vegetable. It looks almost like some sort of a root vegetable. Sort of
exactly.
Round.
It looks like some form of root vegetable in a cross with a coconut because it has that beige-colored thin skin. But, Linda, that's what my mom used to send to me when I went to school as a little girl. It was a big torta or sandwich and a side of jicama or cucumber and carrots drizzled with fresh-squeezed lime juice, a little bit of salt, and some dried ground chili that doesn't have to be spicy. And the incredible thing is people think about Mexican food as being greasy and fattening and over-condimented, and the truth is that most Mexican food is simple like that.
And
I
that's
mean, the jicama...
Yes.
I kind of like the greasy
stuff. And it's a great snack, but you know what? We're going to have to take a short break here. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. My guest is television personality, Patty Hinnich. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more.
You like that, Linda? Are you dancing, Linda?
I'm up here doing a dance here.
I don't see it. Come on, Linda.
Let's dance, Bonnie. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. And my guest is Patty Hinnich. She's the host of Patty's Mexican Table, aired here, right here at WLRN. And her book is also Patty's Mexican Table.
Linda, was that a rose in your mouth there?
Dancing around here? Yeah, Joe, you cut a bean carpet. We've been talking about Cinco de Mayo. It's coming up this Sunday, and we've been talking about Mexican food. But here's a quick dinner in minutes with a kind of a Mexican theme to it. It's a turkey mushroom quesadilla with corn and black bean salad on the side. We mentioned salads just earlier. It's kind of a Mexican-style sandwich made with tortillas. And the mushrooms and spinach can be cooked easily and quickly in the microwave, just a quick couple of minutes. And then I fill the quesadilla, the tortilla, I put in a skillet just for a minute on one side, flip it over, gets a little bit golden, and I put half the side of it, I put some spinach and mushrooms, and then you can have some cooked turkey, or maybe you have some cooked chicken left over, put that in there, a little cheese over that, fold it in half, I put the cover on and let the cheese melt, and that's my easy.
Now, are you saying that either Fred or I could make this in 15 minutes?
Well, Joe, listen up here. You're buying the turkey
maybe
already
Fred
cooked.
Could. Okay.
All right? So that's number one. Number two.
Yeah, I'm willing to try.
The spinach and mushrooms are going in the microwave, okay?
All right.
In between glasses of champagne, right, Fred?
That would be a nice combination, wouldn't it?
Well,
that sounded like a five-minute dinner to me.
Thank you, Patty. I need somebody on my side. Thank you very much for the salad, frozen corn kernels, and some canned black beans that are drained and rinsed with a vinaigrette dressing. Put it over some lettuce leaves. Anyway, Joe, look, you can go on my website, and you can get the whole recipe. That's at dinnerinminutes.com with a photograph. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Fred Tasket, so we're not having margaritas. What are we having?
Well, we're having wine. It's not widely known in the U.S., I suppose, but Mexico has been making wine a lot longer than we have. I looked up the history, and it says that the Spanish conquistador Hernan Cortes, who was in Mexico in the 1500s,
wow,
conquering the Aztecs, ran out of the wine that he brought with him, so he ordered every colonist to plant 1,000 vines. This was in the 1500s. The wine, what they planted was the mission grape, which was called that because they used it for religious purposes in the mission. And the grape could make either red wine or white wine, dry wine or sweet wine, but all had one characteristic in common. They were very wimpy. They were boring, but they did have alcohol, so that was useful for the colonists. Finally, in the 1980s, things got better. A Bordeaux-trained winemaker named Hugo da Costa, who had the idea that the northern end of Baja California in Mexico was close enough to California's climate that he could make good wine there, founded a wine industry, and now it's really growing up in the Guadalupe Valley. There's quite an industry there now. I tasted some of these wines a while ago, and they were pretty good. This year, Wine Enthusiast magazine gave 92 points and an award for Baja's best red wine to the 2007 Viña de Garzas Amado wine, which is a blend of Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Tempranillo, and Zinfandel. And it needs to be good because it's $54 a bottle. And one of the white wines that the Wine Enthusiast liked was the Casa de Piedra Un-Oak Chardonnay, which sells for $23.
Are these wines available in regular stores here?
Well, it is kind of hard to find Mexican wines in the U.S. market, but if you go to BajaWines.com, that's BajaWines.com, you'll find a company that says it can legally ship them to you, so it's worth a try. So now you can celebrate Cinco de Mayo without hurting yourself with all those margaritas.
All right. So, Bonnie, you had an email or a question?
No, I had a question for Patty. You were talking about your sister. You said she makes Mexican-style cupcakes.
Yeah, so she makes Mexican-inspired or Latin-inspired dishes. So, for example, she has a chocolate cupcake. See, my mouth just started watering saying the name. She has the best ever chocolate cupcakes that are filled with cajeta, which is Mexico's dulce de leche. So she has the moistest batter for the cupcakes. I mean, they almost feel wet. And then she has the cajeta filling, which is like caramel. And then she covers them with a thick chocolate ganache. They're incredible.
And wow, can you imagine the calorie count on that? It's probably worth it, but wow.
But let me tell you, that's the thing, and that's one other thing that I say in the cookbook. I have what I think a very complete dessert section, and I say that in Mexico, people are really used to having dessert every day. I mean, I grew up eating dessert every day, and it was a part of the main meal, which in Mexico is a comida, you know, the big lunch, not the dinner. And it was just a slice of something, you know, a slice of pound cake, a piece of Jello, some fresh fruit with orange juice. And there is really a cultural difference in the way we treat desserts. So my kids don't go crazy when they see chocolate or pound cake or something because they're used to having a little bit every day. And I think it's all a matter of balance. You know, you have a little. You don't have to have the dozen of cupcakes, you have one.
Right. You know, another thing I noticed when I was in Mexico City was the chocolate.
Yeah.
You have such wonderful, wonderful chocolate.
Imagine you noticing the chocolate. That's amazing.
Yeah. Is that a surprise? We're at my favorite section here, the dessert section. Okay.
Yeah. I think you may be part Mexican.
Oh, all right. So we only have about a half a minute left, but tell me something. Why is chocolate so good in Mexico?
Because it comes from Mexico. It's, you know, Mexico is one of those native ingredients that has been a gift to the world. And, of course, it has been the process of making chocolate has been, you know, gone wild in Europe and other parts of the world. But that's the place where it originated. And so it has a lot of flavor and depth. And there are a lot of traditions surrounding how to make it and use it. And one specialty that I love is the Mexican-style hot chocolate.
Oh, yes, and wonderful. And you dip those churros?
The churros.
The churros in it?
Churros,
oh,
yeah.
Yes.
I can't roll those R's, but I sure like them.
And you know what?
You can practice with us.
Okay. Patty, this has just been so delightful, but we're just about out of time. Really, really tasty day today. Thank you. Thank you, Patty Hinich, for joining us. Now, her book is Patty's Mexican Table, and you can also see her Mexican table here at WLRN. I guess if you go to WLRN.org, it varies as
they'll
to timing.
They'll have the listing
of it. So congratulations. It's a great book, Patty.
Thank you so much, guys. Thank you for having me on.
Fred Tasker, great advice, as always.
Always a pleasure.
Well, next week, we're going to be talking with Susan Finn. We're going to be talking about eating right to keep fit. Bonnie and Joe, great to be with you today.
Well, likewise, you. Linda.
Well, I'm Linda
and
Gassenheimer.
And Patty.
And join me next week.
And thanks for tuning in this hour. Special salute to our members as well. Topical Currents is produced by Richard Ives. Technical direction from Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. We have free audio archives and downloads of this and past programs at our website, WLRN.org, and more information as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page. See pictures. Tomorrow at 1 o'clock, it's Ed Bell and the South Florida Arts Beat. We return Monday with University of Maryland historian and economics professor Gar Alperovitz, author of What Then Must We Do? And the calendar. On this day in 1939, 74 years ago, baseball Iron Man Lou Gehrig, age 36, stays on the bench after playing 2,130 consecutive games. He dies of amyotrophic lateral sclerosis in 1941. And on this day in 1946, 67 years ago, the birth of singer Leslie Gore in New York City. She recorded It's My Party at age 16. Her producer, Quincy Jones. Cry If I Want To, Judy's Turn to Cry, That's the Way Boys Are, Sunshine, Lollipops and Roses. And what was the number one song on this day in 1999, 14 years ago? Livin' La Vida Loca by former Menudo vocalist Ricky Martin. Today's recipe at DinnerMinutes.com. And we leave with this from Mickey Mantle's Yankee Stadium Farewell in 1969, referring to Lou Gehrig, quote, I never knew how someone dying could say he was the luckiest man in the world, but now I understand. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Linda Gassenheimer. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.